Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the relationship between India and the United States. Now, President Obama has said that relations between the United States and India are among the highest priorities for his administration and also for him personally as president. And certainly, India has very important strategic significance for the United States. It is a very important ally. But perhaps it's worth asking the question, well, having said all that, what do the countries mean to one another? Particularly, what does the United States mean to India? This morning, in this hour of the show, we will try to explore that question, and we have with us two guests. Udaya Narayana Singh, he is the Pro Vice Chancellor of Viswa Bharati University in West Bengal. He is a linguist, poet, playwright, and essayist. Also here in the studio is Madhu Vishwanathan. He's professor of business administration here at University of Illinois. He's been on the faculty here since 1990. And the two of them are taking part in a conference that is sponsored by the International Forum for U.S. Studies at the university. The presence of America in India. Where and how does America appear, and what are the effects? And we wanted to take the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of these things, particularly because Dr. Singh was here visiting. So they said, yes, they'd be happy to come and sit down in the studio with us and talk. And as we do, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions, comments. You can be a part of the conversation. You can call 333-9455 if you're here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And there's also email, so you can send us a thought that way. And that's will-talk, will-talk@illinois.edu. And thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. As I started thinking about this a little bit, if you ask this question, well, in what ways has India and Indian thought and culture affected the United States? People will start to say, well, you know, we have many Americans who practice yoga and they practice meditation. There are people who have come to the idea of nonviolent political action from India, and one can look at that in some rather maybe superficial ways. But I was really struck by a comment, actually, I came across. This was a recent interview with Thomas Pickering, mm-hmm. who had been the ambassador to India from the United States, talking about the relationship. And his comment was something like he thought really most Americans knew very little about India. And perhaps that's why the relationship between India and the United States was so non-controversial, because Americans really didn't know anything about it. What do you think Americans should, at least to start off with, what do you think Americans should know about India?
Well, I think there are lots of things to know about, from film to music to literature and to the political structure of the country, which is quite similar to the United States in terms of the governance structure, except for the nitty-gritty and the details. Mm. But both are democracies, and largest democracies. And I think the success of this system of governance depends a lot on these two countries. So therefore, one needs to understand each other much better.
Yeah. How would you answer that question about, well, what really do you think Americans should know about India?
Yeah, I think what they should know about India is perhaps similar to what they should know about any country in one sense, which is we have to go beyond the words, right? We have to go beyond the labels. And that's true of an Indian looking at America as well. Words will only take you so far. For example, I know there's a caste system in India. But there has also been slow progress in a variety of different ways. And so I'd say look beyond the words, and gosh, India will be shocking, and India will be exhilarating in terms of its diversity and its openness and so on. The words only take us so far. But that's true of, I think, any culture looking at some other culture. Hmm.
So we have heard so much now about a certain number of countries and their growing economic power, and these are the ones that get referred to by the BRIC acronym. So we're talking about Brazil, Russia, India, China. These countries, certainly, I'm sure people in these countries are beginning really to feel their power and are really flexing their muscles economically speaking. What does that mean to people in India? How do Indians think about their place now on the global stage? Are people thinking about that?
Well, I've been in the U.S. for 27 years. When I was growing up, a product made in India did not have much appeal. What has really changed to me when I observe India is self-confidence. It's really self-confidence, not in saying, look, I can make something low cost, but in saying I can make the best in the world. That to me is a dramatic change, and I see that in the young in India.
Huh. And I think the Made in USA was a very important brand, as you heard just now. And Made in China for India was something which is not of good quality, but of cheap thing. But Made in India, of course, was not really valued at all. To that extent, definitely what he said is true. But more than that, I think the self-confidence comes from the fact that we have been able to have a country without the military taking over the ruling of the country, which has happened in our neighborhood several times, which we see. And so that's a danger which we could avoid. We have also seen the collapse of economy in Russian situation. We have also seen the wars that China and Japan had entangled themselves into in the beginning of the last century, which we could somehow avoid. But I think overall it's the economic well-being and it's the progress which has developed the confidence.
I don't know how much we really want to talk about politics, but I think that certainly India is important to the United States because of the priorities of the United States in that part of the world. And that what you read over and over again, that what one of the interests the United States has in India is as an offsetting power, that is to offset the power of China.
Sure.
And I think also, though, that there are people in India that are not real sure about being cast in that role because I'm sure that India is interested in having positive relations with China, and there already are positive, you know, there has been friction, there may be friction, and I'm sure that they don't want anything to make that any worse. Is that, do some Indians see actually that as something of a problem for India, the fact that the United States wants to cast India in that role?
Well, I think the Indians have viewed the United States, at least after 1947, as a very important partner and a very important place for the students in particular. The students of India earlier would go only to European universities. Mm-hmm. And students started going to American universities after 1950s. And this has grown over time. And that, I think, is a proof that Indians have been viewing America as a knowledge superpower. I'm not talking about economic superpower. And there's a lot to learn from the country. In fact, our authors have also been contributing to a significant manner to that direction, because they have been writing about stories of how people have visited America and how they have come back with a kind of knowledge and kind of wisdom, with perhaps development of new areas of governance, new area of business. So to that extent, I think it is very important that Indians have been learning from American situation. On the other side, I think if you look at Americans, the way they have been viewing India as a partner, this has grown. Of course, as you said, there have been areas of friction. But this has grown over time. And I think as the time has progressed, there's more maturity in understanding India.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn here to Madhu Vishwanathan. Maybe I should mention some names so people who are listening can keep the two of you straight and know who it is that they're listening to. Maybe you can talk a little bit about a university like the University of Illinois, or students like the students that you have, having a relationship is something that's important probably on a number of levels.
Absolutely. I think India is, you know, such an arena to learn about so many different things. So let me talk from a business student's point of view. The U.S. has is so advanced in so many different ways, but also being advanced may make you less prepared to be nimble, to find new ways to innovate. And that's what's coming out of a country like India, a very different form of entrepreneurship. So many innovative solutions in resource constraints and so on. You also see a wide range of India. You see the extreme poverty, and you see the best companies in the world in India as well. And so students going there get full exposure. We have a number of programs to a number of countries, and certainly quite a few of our students visit India, and they find the whole experience life-changing. They see things side by side. They see the the Taj Mahal. They see the Infosys. They see the the 5-star hotels. But they see the extreme poverty as well. And they just seem to be amazed at how India works, how the typical Indian takes things in stride. How the poor Indian woman is able to do what she does. And so it's just, I think, a shocking and an exhilarating experience for them. But just to put it in business terms, I really think that we don't have a choice but to be looking to educate our students in this manner. Most of the people being added to the world are going to be in emerging markets. And to know how to work with emerging markets, to know how to work with different cultures, different languages, and so on, it's just absolutely critical for our American student. Mm.
And you seem to think that, seem to be arguing, we chatted a little bit before the show, that looking at India gave you a really good opportunity to talk about and think about and study globalization and the important trends that are going on around the world.
I'm particularly interested in looking at India in terms of the global challenges we face, and just to mention two, poverty and the environment. Mm-hmm. And you see this in very stark terms in a low-income setting in India. I mean, it's not something that can be pushed away, or it's not something where we can put the windows of our car up and, drive off. It's right there. If you use plastic, you can see what that does to the neighborhoods and so on in terms of blocking sewage. And so I think this is a unique opportunity for my students to learn about global challenges and to learn about how business can play a role as well in meeting some of these global challenges.
Mm. Maybe I should just very quickly introduce again our guest, Madhu Vishwanathan. He's a professor of business administration here at University of Illinois. And also here in the studio with me is Udaya Narayana Singh. He's the Pro Vice Chancellor of Viswa Bharati University in West Bengal. And they're both taking part in a conference, taking a look at the presence of America in India. Where and how does America appear in India, and what are the effects? It's going on today and tomorrow, I also believe, on the campus, and sponsored by the International Forum for U.S. Studies. And here, questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, something that people, I'm sure, around the world lament always is that the power of American culture, particularly American popular culture, is something that you just cannot get away from. So in what ways do you find America in India? Particularly, I guess, American popular culture, but maybe you would want to go beyond just that.
Yeah. In fact, the exposure to American pop culture has also given us the confidence to explore into Indian traditions of different kind. Mm-hmm. In Bengal, because I've lived in four different corners of India, and it's not just a question of Americans not knowing so much about India. It's also about Indians not knowing so much about India, because one corner is so different from the other corner. And there is this popular as well as the classical tradition in each area, which is so different from the other area, obviously because of their background, because these people develop their music and culture and everything differently. Now, the exposure to the different kind of culture, because they were exposed to only European culture, thanks to the British and the French and the Portuguese who had come into India early. But once the American pop culture came in, which was so different from the European traditions, in every field, And these people have also started to look into the other areas of India and see what are the popular cultures of India. I think that has been the tremendous influence that has been there in India to discover oneself. In a way, exposure to America is also a way of learning about yourself. Yeah. And that's very interesting. And we didn't know so much about America. In fact, in my area, which is language, people started to know about the American, variety of American languages, American cultures, which exist even to this day, besides the mainstream English, Spanish, American.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's a great point. I just wanted to add one experience, which is when we won the World Cup in 2011. And the last time we won the World Cup, it was in 1983. But this time, I was thinking about the Indian psyche. And I was thinking about, wow, isn't this like a modern-day Lagan story, you know, in the way we got together. But these are not the ways I thought about the 1983 victory. And so Uday's point is so well taken. I think we've learned how to express ourselves, and as a result, we are learning about ourselves.
There has been, within maybe the last decade or maybe more than that, I think that there have been a lot of Indian writers who write in English, who have been very successful outside of India, particularly in the United States, and sure. I assume also in Britain, but particularly in the United States.
Sure.
And at the same time, there are many more writers in India that don't write in English. Their work isn't maybe not translated in English, so that there's, I'm sure, a great world of Indian literature that Americans don't see and can't appreciate. Is there? I wonder, for those people who have some sort of contact with Indian literature, what it is that they're missing, because there's only this little part of it that they can read.
Let me give you a little bit of background on this. Mm-hmm. At this point of time, if you're looking at the Indian languages and the productivity in the area of literature, mm-hmm. or other areas, mass media, for instance. India actually has roughly about 3,600 newspapers and journals, and it publishes in 101 languages. It has about 70,000 publishing houses, and it has a radio network with 146 languages. So if you look at this mind-boggling statistics, you would understand that it's natural that there will be a huge number of writers who are not really reaching English reading audience at all. Mm-hmm. And it's only a few who have been able to write directly into English and be read by the millions here. But the beginning was made in India by bilingual authors, people who wrote in both languages, the Indian languages and English. And I think that was the beginning. And today, of course, we have the likes of Chumpa Lahiri or Amitav Ghosh. And these people are read by much more number of readers all over the world, but they don't write in the Indian languages. Mm-hmm. So we have two kinds of writers. We have also people like O.V. Vijayan and Kiran Nagarkar today, who write in both, say, Malayalam, Marathi, and also in English. So we have had really three kinds of situations. In the beginning, we had only writers who wrote in our languages, but they've been reading English stuff. They've been reading English and French great authors, Russian great authors, but writing in Indian languages. Then came the authors who wrote in both languages. And then came the authors who wrote only in English. And now we have also lots of authors who write in both languages. Mm. So there have been very interesting changes in the way writers have worked in India. And somebody from America who would wish to know about Indian writing perhaps will now have to depend on translations of great Indian authors into English.
Mm. I'm really struck. You talked a little bit earlier about Indians starting to perhaps learn more about their own country and its great cultural diversity, and the fact that it is an enormous country and that depending on where you go, particularly north, south, east, west,
yes.
There are people who the music is different, the food is different, the language is different,
yes, of course.
The culture is different. These enormous differences. So, how does that make the idea of thinking about Indian identity difficult?
It's easy and difficult both. One, because India has been a country of travelers. In fact, recently when the attempt was made to have a unique identification number, UID, floated by Nandan Nilekani, the problem with that system was that 15 to 20% Indians have been traveling all the time. In fact, within India, they have been traveling enormously. So this traveling culture made it possible to be exposed, one area to being exposed to the other area. But at the same time, people have also been making a lot of compromises in terms of their languages as they travel. But they have not really made so much effort to learn the other's language, which is a problem because there are 22 major languages. So 96% population in India speak those 22 languages which are in the constitution. Now, 22 is a large number, and I don't think anybody can learn that many languages. However, people who have been living in one region they have generally been conversant with at least three or four languages. So in a way, Indians have been multilingual anyway. And I think that has made it easier for them to understand the other. But you are right, India did not have a geopolitical existence before the British came. It was divided into so many principalities and so many kingdoms, and each one knew only about the kingdom that one lived in, and also perhaps about a few other famous kingdoms who could be dangerous for them, but not really about the whole country. It was actually only a cultural space. The concept of India was only as a cultural space, not really as a political space. So to know about the nation-state India on the whole is only something which Indians have started doing after 1950s.
Mm. One of the things that linguists track is language loss, the fact that languages are disappearing. Is that something that concerns people in India?
It is. Recently, particularly the UNESCO's recent World Atlas of Endangered Languages, for which 30 people worked, including myself, very few from Asia, though. That has put India in a bit strange situation because we did not know much about the Indian loss. Because there was earlier version of the World Atlas, 1991 version, had the United States on top. But this time, we had India with 196 endangered languages and USA with 192. So the situation in India is as bad as in America. This has really concerned a lot of people, readership, as well as the leaders of the country. And many steps are being taken to see what they can do about these languages. It should not happen the way it happened in Australia and New Zealand and in USA.
Is it the case that that languages are being lost because people are moving to one of the more commonly spoken Indian languages like Hindi, or is it because their language is being lost in favor of English?
No, but as I said, 96% people speak 22 languages, but 4% people speak other thousands of languages. So the number of people speaking a particular language quite often is very small, between 200 to 2,000 or 5,000. So this is a critical problem, a typical situation where a number is dwindling and people move to the other areas for better opportunities. But you are also right that some languages are facing threat because their speakers en masse become speakers of another language, economically endowed language of power. Yeah. And that is definitely a great problem.
Yeah. Just now, I'm curious, Professor Viswanathan, this is a very different subject, but again, I guess I'm thinking about the great diversity that you find in India. If you're in the business of selling things, if you're in the business of marketing, how do you develop a strategy to deal with a country where you have that level of diversity?
Absolutely. In fact, what we focus on is the low-income marketplace there. Mm-hmm. I think the first thing to do is to get a mind transplant, because we tend to think in top-down terms. Yeah. We tend to think, you know, here's my market. Well, I'm going to do market research. I have my universe. I'm going to find a sample of people. It's all top-down. Or here's how I'm going to communicate. I'm going to get a media buy from these channels. You got to completely throw that out and figure out how you're going to stitch your markets from the bottom up. Each village is different. The different group influences on villages are different. The marketplace is intertwined with the social structure and so on. And so literally you've got to start with the opinion leaders. You've got to start with that, you know, that micro level of that village, and then try to figure out how can I learn to build the relationships there so they know who I am. And then maybe, you know, move from there radially outward. And I want to make sure and, you know, go to these kinds of listening, community, so to speak, or listening laboratories, though I don't like that word, in a variety of different parts of India, including the 4% that Uday talked about, and really learn from there and then try to figure out how I move outward from there. So even words like scale have to be used very carefully. I really don't care too much for that word. It's really a different concept of reaching people.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus a little bit about India and about Indian relations between India and the United States with two guests, Udaya Narayana Singh and Madhu Viswanathan. And we'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus with the 2012 Klein Symposium keynote address, Religious Obstacles to Democratization in the Middle East, Past and Present, by Duke University professor Timur Kuran, Monday, April 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. Details at kleincenter.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is our morning talk program, and we are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. And let me just mention that in the second hour today, we'll be talking about computers. This is something that we do each month on the show. Celeste Quinn will be hosting. Jim Irick and Deborah Flieger will be the guests. So this is an opportunity for you to ask questions if you're having a problem with your computer, or maybe you're thinking about buying a new one and you need some advice. That's what we'll do. Also, then, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, we will be talking about China, and we'll be talking about something that is a very important demographic trend in China, and that is the movement of people from rural areas to cities. Every year, over 200 million people move from the countryside to the city. And we'll talk about what that means for China, for the people involved, and the guest will be Michelle Loyalka. She is a freelance journalist and editor, and she is author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of her book is Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can find out what we'll do in the days ahead by going to our website. You can check the schedule. You can also listen to past programs, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. This is Focus, our morning talk show, and I'm pleased to have here in studio with me Uday Narayana Singh. He is a pro vice chancellor of Viswa Bharati University in West Bengal. He is here visiting the campus. Along here with me is also Madhu Viswanathan. He is a professor of business administration here at the U of I, and both of them taking part in a big conference sponsored by the International Forum for U.S. Studies here at the U of I, talking about the presence of America in India. Where and how does America appear, and what are the effects? And we're talking a little bit here about relations between India and the United States and how the two countries and their cultures affect one another. And you can call in, ask questions, make comments, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe people might just like to hear you talk a little bit about your university. And the one thing I know about it is that this university was started by the great Indian artist, writer, teacher, Rabindranath Tagore.
Yeah. Actually, the university started only as an effort of de-schooling. As you know, Tagore is a famous school dropout. He did not study formally in any institution. And when he got the opportunity of creating this institution, he thought of creating first a school which is a nature school, much like Steiner's concept of nature school, started around the same time. So 1901 actually is the time when Tagore established what he called a school in Shantiniketan. The area is called Shantiniketan, where this university is located. Mm-hmm. And this was, this is about 200 kilometers away from Kolkata. And the school grew into a university because 1905 onwards, he made an effort to send his own son to the University of Illinois. In fact, his son is an alumni of University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, studied agriculture here because he wanted to develop the university to do not just art and literature and fine arts, performing arts and communication, but also work in rural reconstruction and agricultural research. So this has grown into a very fine institution with a lot of balance between two campuses. One campus is Shantiniketan. Shanti in Indian language is peace. And another campus is Sriniketan. Sri Indian languages is wealth. So it's important that you work on the well-being of the rural people. Also important that you establish peace through art and music and culture. So the focus of the university and the fame and name of the university is for the two schools, the art school, Kala Bhavan, and the music school, Sangeet Bhavan. It also has sciences and humanities. There have been very well-known people who have been alumni of that university, including one of our former prime ministers, Mrs. Indira Gandhi. It has also had some of the best teachers who have made India proud in various fields. And all this is, this was possible by private donations, because only four universities in India at this point of time, if you look back at the history of Indian universities, were started by private individuals. Two of them by Maharajas, Mysore and Baroda. One by a social worker and political thinker in Banaras Hindu University. And this one, Shantiniketan, by a poet and dreamer. So in a way, it's very different from the other universities started by the government.
Yeah, I just I find myself thinking about the about this university being a land grant university. It was started with government money, and the idea was that it was supposed to give people practical skills. So that they could contribute to the economy of the growing country and also be good citizens. I think, though, probably still fairly early on, people thought that wasn't the only thing that students needed to know, that they needed to know about art and cultural and other things. Sure. Although I'm sure it was also very controversial that they were, at the time, I'm sure people here on this campus said, oh, what do farm boys need to know about art? But fortunately, some people said, no, actually, that they really do. And it does make me think about the constant wrestling, I guess, between this idea that in higher education, how do you balance the practical with the spiritual?
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. And in fact, that's exactly what Tagore tried doing. How exactly you can balance this. Balance is the word. You've hit the right word. The key word is balance. And he practiced what is called a non-denominational religious practices on the campus, in a sense that we had the Islamic festivals being celebrated, the Christianity, particularly Christmas being celebrated, and the rest of it, some of the Hindu festivals being celebrated, but no gods and goddesses. And it was only really the major festivals which the university practiced were the change of season, the beginning of summer, the beginning of winter, the beginning of rains. These are the things which were being celebrated by Tagore. And this shift of emphasis from religion to culture, bringing them close to the nature. Because the school that is still working there in the university, where it's a very coveted school called Patho Bhavan and Shikha Shatra, the classes are held under the trees. So the students still go from one tree to the other tree, and the teachers remain under the trees. Except for the laboratory classes where you have to get into the buildings. Mm. But the rest of it, even today, are actually under the tree. And students are really taken from one kind of space to the other kind of space to know more about nature. This is typical for the last 100 years. This has been going on.
Fascinating. Questions, by the way, are welcome here. We're talking, and we'll be talking for about another 10, 12 minutes. Udaya Narayana Singh is here. He is the Pro Vice Chancellor of Visva Bharati University in West Bengal, and also here in studio with me as well, Madhu Vishwanathan. He's Professor of Business Administration here at University of Illinois. Questions, comments, welcome. You want to shape the conversation any way you like, do that. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me come back here, and I think that it is the case that, say, the University of Illinois and other universities are interested in establishing presences and relationships with other institutions of higher learning, or either existing ones or starting them. And we're seeing it here at the University of Illinois. Two of the big emerging economies are very important areas of focus. Brazil is one, and India is the other. What does it mean to the university to have those kinds of connections and to work to establish those kinds of connections?
I think it means a tremendous amount. You mentioned earlier about, art and culture and agriculture. Mm-hmm. I guess I was thinking we are in the middle of the cornfields. I claim we are the best university in the middle of nowhere. We don't have a choice. We have to have these engagements no matter where we are today. In fact, our geographic location makes it all the more important to have these kinds of connections. I think from a research point of view, it really opens up, venues. It opens up possibilities. If I'm a researcher here and I say I can't imagine doing research in India, I think knowing Uday and knowing about their university would just open up my imagination and say, wow, I could be doing this or that. I think so. That's a very practical function that these kinds of relationships serve. And then students, and student exchange programs and students visiting. That is so exciting. I think the best way to get anything going, in my view, is to get students involved and to have them involved in these kinds of exchanges. But David, can I go back to the education issue?
Sure.
As somebody who's lived outside India for 27 years, but has, had a lot of engagement there. What I find among the people we work with, particularly the low-income people in India, is the deep aspiration to make sure that their children get an education. It is just amazing the sacrifices that poor parents make to make that happen. It's almost like education is my path out. Education is the way I'm going to prevent this suffering to go on in the next generation. When I look at India in terms of education, from a distance, I see how quantitatively a lot of the issues have been addressed in terms of the availability of schools so that girl in a village can still get to 8th grade and so on. Now, obviously, qualitatively, it's a different story in terms of what exactly that 8th grade means. There's also these two tiers. I have a number of people working for me who have, master's, degrees as well, and bachelor's, but it was more from the local language rather mm-hmm. than the English medium. They cannot pierce the English medium, educated, person and that person's world, nowhere near in terms of income and so on, won't be able to pierce that world because they cannot communicate at that level, even though they have all the basic skills. So I see that happening as well. And then as I move up, I see this whole issue of creating knowledge and the need in India to have a bigger emphasis on creating knowledge. It does not have to be imitating the West. It does not have to be imitating the US. I don't think that's the way to go. But it's got to be contextualized knowledge. It's got to be the Indian approach to basic research and knowledge creation. I think that's a very important arena for India.
Yeah. We have somebody who calling in here to join the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is on the cell phone on our line number one. Hello.
Hello, yes. Very wonderful program. I'm enjoying it. I just wanted to ask the guests to touch upon the influence of Hollywood on Bollywood, Hollywood, Tollywood, and so on. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, I thank you. And I'm sure that now there are at least a few Americans who have had the opportunity to see at least a couple of Indian films. And maybe they understand that, you know, India has one of the biggest film industries. Maybe it's the biggest film industry in the entire world.
In fact, if you think that Bombay is the only one which produces Indian films, which is a mistake many people make, then we should know that there are other spots, cultural spots in the country, like Hyderabad and Bangalore and Chennai, that make a much bigger number of films. If you put them together, you're right, that this is perhaps the biggest film industry. And I think there was a time when technologically India was in much worse situation and did not produce that kind of film which Hollywood had produced. But more than the technology, it is the tightness of the Hollywood script, the acting qualities, and the final edited stuff which had attracted and gripped the attention of the viewers in India decade after decade. That has come in India only recently. Mm-hmm. From a purely initial amateurish kind of film industry to grow into a very major film-producing industry with international appeal, the rhythm they have been able to find in the recent times, and something which attracts the viewers all over the world, they have known only in the recent times. Although Indians are very nostalgic about the 1950s and 1960s films in India, which are not made anymore, but they also know the power of the recent, you know, film productions which have come. And that has made good business. And in fact, today, fortunately, because of our variety of languages and literatures and cultures, stories coming from various parts of India, I think the film industry has been doing well because of that, because of the variety that it starts with.
As you say, that there are different film industries in different regions of India in working in different languages, and that probably the thing that people have seen here in the United States, unless they've really gone out of their way to try to find some films, would be Bollywood films that are made in Hindi.
Yeah.
And that I think that if people have seen these movies, they will understand that there are certain conventions that are characteristics of these movies, and
typical,
that some people will find wonderful and some people will find sort of baffling.
Yeah, of course.
But are there ways in which that cinema and its conventions have been influenced by Western cinema, particularly by American movies, that they have changed at all, or is it still in many ways in the way stories are told that it's pretty much the same way that they have been told?
No, I think the way of storytelling has changed as much as the music has enormously gained from the exposure to American music. What has been good thing is that they have been able to mix the two traditions, the Indian tradition and the Western tradition in the Hollywood films. And in terms of business, of course, many companies have come up with multiple versions of these films. There will be a version in Tamil, another version in Kannada, another version in Hindi, the same film. And you can't really find out the difference. So multi-version films, as well as groups which are emerging from Hyderabad but making Bengali films. People who are actually beginning from Bollywood, I mean Bombay, but making Tamil films. This is something which has been happening in the recent times. And this model of really working with several languages at the same time, right from the beginning, when you start writing the script and the dialogue and plan out the sequences, has worked as a great advantage, you know, because then they can able to capture a couple of markets at the same time.
Yeah, sell a lot more tickets that way.
Yeah.
Let's talk with somebody in Champaign here, line number one. Hello.
I'm very happy that you mentioned Bangalore. In the health system, we have a great many Indian medics working here in Champaign, the Patels in particular. But what is the situation of ordinary health care in India, and then going all the way up to the 1,000-bed heart operation or hospital in Bangalore? And then how is that financed?
Well, I think the medical tourism has been catching on in India in a great manner. In fact, the cities coming up, like Vedanta City in near Delhi, with a huge number of hospitals, and same is the case with the Bangalore and Chennai and Vellore, particularly coming up in a significant manner. In fact, the neighborhood countries are now depending a lot on Indian medics and doctors. I think this has been also one of the success areas of Indian business entrepreneurs. And to that extent, I think India has really done very well by providing the service, at least, to so many people.
Now, I just wanted to add, David, that this is a very good example of learning from a different context, and you know, which can lead to innovation back to the U.S. For example, in villages, there's the concept of telemedicine. And I can see how that would apply back home, right here in the U.S., in terms of healthcare issues in a variety of states. So the being open to the notion that it's not that anymore the case that technologies develop in the West and then they get adopted in the East, but there is this possibility of a reverse flow of knowledge, a reverse flow of innovation. I think that is perhaps the biggest lesson to be learned from a business point of view.
Well, what I think that the caller was also wondering about for the average Indian citizen, what sort of access to healthcare they have, and do they have access to healthcare?
Well, they have some access, but I don't think they have the kind of access which is desirable. Mm-hmm. It's a very large country, and the number of doctors and medical facilities available would be much less than the number of these things that are required. But at the same time, we have also the alternative medicine, which is very crucial, the herbal system, the homeopathic system, and the other systems, which have been gaining in popularity in the Western countries these days. It's like the vegetarianism catching on in America. So I think to that extent, you know, the caller is right that we need to develop these things much more. But the emphasis that has been given by the Indian government in opening up another 400 universities, at this point of time, you know, India has 419. Another 400 universities coming up in India, and with a lot more medical colleges. And I think that, plus the compulsory one-year work for the doctors in the rural areas, which is a system which is going to come up very soon in India by change of law in the way the medical science will be taught in the country. These two together perhaps would alter the situation.
In developing all those universities, is this more about just trying to provide greater access to higher education? Is there any concern about the numbers of Indian students that are leaving India to come to either to the United States or to other places for university?
There is a great concern. In fact, there's a great mismatch between the number of American students going to India as part of the exchange program and the number of Indians leaving the country to come to United States and other countries to study abroad. But at the same time, the number of students who need to study in the higher education sector is so large, and number of bright kids is so many, so much, that I don't think we need to be really worried about the large number of people leaving. The question is how many of those people can contribute back home to whatever they're doing abroad. That's the question which is important. Mm.
And is there that concern that, that, in fact, those people will go, they'll come to the United States and they won't go back home?
Well, I think the question was about 20 years ago, people talked about brain drain. The drain is gone now. Mm. It's true that brain is going to various places. But I think eventually the global world that we are developing together is helping people to really contribute back home in so many ways and significantly.
Yeah, I just want to add to that, David, that when I came here in 1985, the path was, you know, to get an education and, you know, look for opportunities here. That is changing. You know, it's, I would never have predicted that in 1985, but it started changing in the perhaps the mid to late 90s. And I know of quite a few people who consider a variety of options, including, you know, going back to India. That is changing. Mm. It's changed quite a bit, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Well, you know, I think we are going to have to stop at this point just because we have come to the end of the time. And I want to say thanks very much to our guests, Madhu Vishwanathan. He's a professor of business administration here at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here. And Udaya Narayana Singh, he's the pro vice chancellor of Vishwabharati University. That's in West Bengal.
Thank you.
Thank you. And they are both here to, taking part in a big conference looking at the presence of America in India. Where and how does America appear and what are the effects? Sponsored by the International Forum for U.S. Studies here at the University of Illinois.